Hi, this is Aaron Norris, and welcome to Buying System Number 1, Buying First Day MLS. The first part of this lesson is the nuts and bolts of the system, essentially the how-to, directly from Bruce Norris himself. In the second part of the chapter, Bruce and I interview longtime investor and real estate agent Andrea Jennings, who shares with us when the strategy is the most effective and how it changes in each quadrant. We even cover how it changed over time due to technology. So sit back and relax, and let's explore how real estate investors can quickly spot discounted properties on the first day they hit the MLS. You'll even learn that it's not just the deal itself that is the most important part of the strategy.
This is buying system number one, and this is where a lot of the deals that Andrea and I did came about, where these properties were listed below market right out of the chute. But when you find an agent, you definitely want to get an agent to work with that's not a seasoned pro. What attracted me to Andrea, I called her off of an ad that she ran. That's how we met. And it was just a well-written ad. I called and I went in to meet her. And from there, we built this buying system up. But when you work with somebody that doesn't have their mind made up that working with an investor is lousy, it's a good start. We want somebody to be at least open-minded where they say, okay, you know, maybe we'll give this a shot. They're used to working with first-time buyers, so there's huge time investment. They're babysitting weekends and evenings and a lot of disloyalty. I just want to find an agent that's creative and aggressive. That was a flyer that we sent out. And I think there were 1,200 agents in Riverside at the time. And as I recall, I got one phone call. And it was a good phone call. So it was an agent that ended up being RE/MAX's Rookie of the Year. We still have a relationship, but he really went into other than real estate to make his fortune. But I knew he was going to do well. He ended up being a millionaire probably before he was 30. But that realtor produced him, but no other phone call. That gives me an idea that a lot of realtors have already made up their mind that we're not worth working with. So you have to really get a good agent that's open-minded to work with. The advantages we've already talked about, so I'm not going to go over those. But one thing that is important is that the investor, this is under just a second comment, investor knows the business and they're a help when crunch time comes. That, to me, is the biggest difference between being in an escrow with a first-time buyer and being in an escrow with an investor, is that escrows have problems sometimes. And when you're a first-time buyer, any problem comes up, you're likely to try to find an exit, where an investor is very likely to create the solution and have a team that's built around solutions instead of trying to make an escrow disappear. So it's important that when a broker starts working with you, that you let them understand and let them know that you're going to be a help whenever things happen. Be a person that's easy to give bad news to. I think that's real important, because if they find something out that's going to maybe stand in the way and they're afraid to tell you, the only thing that happens, it grows until it's impossible to solve. I want to be able to have the reputation where if somebody's got a problem, there's a title issue, it's a qualifying issue, termite inspection is too expensive. I want to be the kind of person somebody can say, you know what, tell Bruce right now, let's see what we can do. I have trained my brain to go to solution mode instead of whine about the problem. So if you give me any business problem, I guarantee you my mind starts spitting out solutions instead of worrying about the problem. It's just something I've trained myself to do. One thing that's kind of important is that as you, whatever outreach you do, let's say we run some ads that we buy property in the future, or we do mailers to people that own properties, you could set up a referral base very easily with a broker that you're working with that makes offers on your behalf out of the MLS, to where you refer business to them and maybe they give you a referral fee for that client. House you wouldn't buy, why not maybe get a referral fee to where it starts covering your entire cost of advertising? So you really work as a team. You get little pieces of commission, and you're able to advertise more and more. There was a realtor that I did business with who started a website. His entire income is pretty much derived from two things. He buys wholesale deals, which he had seen me do and picked up, but he has this referral base. He refers out these calls he gets, he generates leads, and he deals with referring out to other RE/MAX agents. The guy is making $1 million a year in referral fees from a website-driven activity where he literally just sends leads out to other top-flight RE/MAX agents and gets 25% of their commission. He's so busy, he can hardly stand it. You can set up an arrangement to where you can get some compensation and just continue the process where they're paying for your advertising, and that creates more compensation for both of you. Basically, when you start a relationship with an agent that you're going to work with, you want them to do a few simple things. And this is dealing with buying system number one is dealing with only first day listings in the MLS. It's not dealing with anything that's existing. It's not dealing with expired. It's dealing with the ones that show up today. And we're looking for something very specific. We want this agent to input a search criteria into the computer. So we want key buzzwords that might come out into a motivated listing. Vacant property, lender owned, as is, things like that. Or maybe even a criteria. You want to know all the listings at this price and below. You customize the search to where every first day listing that matches the search, we know about. So that's what buying system is about. Buying system number one is about, is setting up a process that when you make an offer, it has the parts to it that make it acceptable. Under number three, in the middle it says, agent must be willing to submit offers on these properties quickly, and you can expect competition when something gets dumped into the MLS at a big discount. So you have to be first. Do I offer full price if it's already in an acceptable level? Yes. The key is to get it under contract. I have played the games where I didn't want to offer full price and done. Got sold to somebody else. I know this might seem like an exceptional deal. It is not. The first fourplex I bought out of this area, out of the MLS, was $50,000. A fourplex completely fixed by a lender that we resold for $139,900 in the MLS for $50,000. I didn't negotiate that one either. Okay, I just bought it. But and we'll show you how to take that comp and use it as a chain reaction for other deals. These are the things that this offer has to have to be accepted. It has to be all cash. So you do not try to buy this property in a 30-day escrow and having a loan contingency. It just simply won't be competitive. So you have to have a way to be buying this for cash. Doesn't have to be your money, but it has to have the appearance of this is going to happen quickly. So a quick close. The truth is, if it's lender-owned, you probably could close it quicker than they can. So if we can perform in 10 to 14 days, there's a lot of times where you'll go into a 14-day escrow with a lender, but then you'll find that their paperwork may not be back east from a signature that they need. That can happen as well. But we have to have a 10 to 14-day close, all cash. You're going to buy this as is, and you should have no contingency. In other words, you should have seen this house. I would not make an offer, all cash, with a speedy close, and not have seen the property. That's a mistake. So you have to physically see it, and I personally see the property rather than delegate that to somebody. So that's just a habit of mine, because I'm the one that's going to get stuck with whatever I say yes to. If you put a bunch of contingencies in this offer, it won't get accepted. So it has to be a very clean deal. And if you have verification of cash by bank account or by letter from the Norris Group, that part is also going to be necessary. You need to make sure that they understand that you have the wherewithal to close it. What Andre and I used to do is, I recall, we had pre-signed offers so we could make it as quick as possible. I would take a look at the first day MLS, and I'd start my car within a minute. I would make a beeline to the property. I would call her up on the cell phone. I'd say, we're going to make an offer on this property. I'll let you know when I go through it. Within a few minutes, I'd be at the property. I'd run around to see if it was in awful shape or okay shape. And then I would tell her what the number was and already had it signed. We already had a deposit in place. Within a very short period of time, we had an offer presented on a property that had just shown up in the MLS. And a lot of times they pay attention to the first offer. There are some listings that say we're going to accumulate offers for the first 72 hours, but there's a lot of times where that doesn't happen. They pay attention to the first one that's there, and if it's acceptable, then you're done. And all the other competition, if they're late, they're late. They're just not going to get a chance. Now, one of the most important things in buying system number one has nothing to do with the property that you buy, but the agent that listed the property. And this is something that you have to work out with the agent that you work with, because this is how people get into the REO business, is they get their first lender listing, and then they get a relationship, and they get more and more. What do you think? Just think about the agent that listed this property on Sheila. A fourplex worth $140,000 listed at $74,900. Think about what might be important about that person. Number one, do they have the ability to negotiate a lender to a reasonable price? Absolutely. And that's very important. What that tells me is that's a strong agent that isn't trying or over trying to get a listing from a lender. And the MLS will be full of those, to where the lender has a property that needs work that's worth $140,000 and it'll be listed for $135,000 because it needs $5,000 worth of work. That is not an exciting listing. And in a market that's bad, it's going to expire. That's not who I'm looking for. I'm looking for an agent that could turn into the next whale. But because this $140,000 listing is in here for $74,900, do I think I now have an indication that they don't have an investor to work with? Doesn't that tell me that? Probably. And so I have to make an arrangement to be able to work directly with that agent on inventory that they control, because ultimately what's going to happen is that that agent will find an investor to work with, and they will go directly to that new investor with the inventory. Now, there are some agents, and this happened with Andre and I, that only want to do it in the MLS and have no problem getting Andrea's offer, and we'll get to see all of the inventory that they'll ever get. That's fine. But it isn't always that way. And so this is what this first day buying system does. It not only finds great deals, but it constantly gives you the new agents that are entering into listing lender-owned properties. And it constantly gives you a chance to build new relationships where properties start coming to you directly. The more relationships you have on people that'll control inventory, the better off you are and the better off your agent is. That's system number one, is basically setting up a process to where you catch the super deal right out of the chute. You do not want to start representing yourself in the wholesale world. You don't want to be perceived as getting paid and buying something below market. It's not going to set well, and you will not build relationships. What you'll do is end up eliminating yourself from a lot of inventory.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. Today we are joined, and I get to interview Bruce Norris, of course, CEO of the Norris Group, and then Andre Jennings, who is an award-winning realtor. You're with McKee Real Estate right now. I know that name. I went to school with Ryan. Over the years, she's worked with buyers, sellers, and even investors. She started her career in the early 90s and began working with Bruce in 1993. And from 96 to 2002, she had owned and operated her own successful real estate business. And during this last downturn, she joined the dark side as an investor and worked both as a realtor and investor. So welcome to the show. And today is a little bit different. We're going to be renovating buying systems. I first came onto the Norris Group back in 2005 with two goals. Number one was to back in the Norris Group into a California-only company with your market timing report, the California crash, 400 pages, 1,000 charts, 2 days of nothing but charts.
mind numbing is great. Followed up by the California Only Investor Series, which ended up being over 1,200 pages, 44 CDs worth of 40 hours of how-to information of your entire career put on paper. So a decade later, things have changed. So the one thing we didn't get to do in the buying systems is go through each buying strategy, and there are 24, talking about how it changes by quadrant. And technology has definitely changed some of those things, so we're going to cover that today. So if you've never been to one of our education events, it's important to understand the quadrants, and you can always go to thenorrisgroup.com/freemium, and if you register there, you have access to a few free chapters, Chapter 6 in Investor Essentials and Buying Systems Chapter 1. But really quick, to frame the conversation, Quadrant 1 is moving from a hot market to a flat market, so a good example of the last downturn would be 2006 to 2007, would you say?
Quadrant 4.
Quadrant 1. So
it's the flat market.
Right, correct. And then Quadrant 2, from a flat market to a bust market.
Right.
So 07 to 2008, roughly.
2011.
Well,
it
because...
It lasted a while.
Okay, well, Q3, Quadrant 3 is a bust to a flat market. So what would you consider those years?
It's the flat market. It's the little piece in between the upside, and so it's... The downturn has ended, so you have Quadrant 3 as a flat.
Okay.
Quadrant 4 begins this long rise.
Right.
So the two quadrants that have lengthy years are 2 and 4.
Okay.
The transitions are 1 and 3.
Right. And that, yeah, in this last cycle, Quadrant 1 was short and painful then.
Well, and the timing of that is really important because if you're holding the wrong inventory at the end of Quadrant 4 and Quadrant 1 hits, land, one-bedroom condos, you know it changed like right now.
Well, and the buying strategies change really quickly as well. So I think that's something unique that we bring to the market. So let's dig in. How did the two of you meet?
Actually, Andre was very instrumental in me even creating the buying systems and all the things because what happened, I was, for the 80s, I was running ads in the newspaper buying 100% of whatever I was buying directly from people. And then around 1990, my ad calls doubled off the same ad, and my purchases went down by 90%. And I was feeling like I was a counselor instead of an investor because everyone was upside down. And it was awful. And then I remembered, this looks like some other time I experienced. And it was then when I started seeing the HUD auctions start happening. And then I thought, I need access to the MLS. And you ran a really good ad, Andre. I remember reading the ad, and I said, that is a really cool ad. And so I called her, and then we met, and I didn't have access to the MLS. And so I think we had books at the time.
Yeah, what's interesting is the person I met was we were just transitioning from the MLS books to a system that was the original system called Lightning.
Okay.
Lightning.
It was called Lightning. And
it probably wasn't. But
true.
And it was on paper.
And that's really how we first started with the buying system was, you know, looking through the information and your dad. I remember it was back when we printed with the perforated pages. And your dad said, print everything in this price range and give it to me. And it was a stack, like several inches. And he went through every one of them. And then called me and he faxed me over a list and there was probably 15 properties on that list. And he said, I want to write an offer on every one of these. And that's how we started.
But see, I knew the deals had flown somewhere, but it like Who Moved My Cheese book was perfect. So my cheese moved, but I had no idea how to access them. And then I remembered, wait a minute, this is reminding me of a past time. But I hadn't coordinated that in a sequence. Mm-hmm. So I was starting to be in quadrant two, but I didn't recognize what I was supposed to do yet. Mm-hmm. And so when we got access to the MLS, I was seeing these listings going, oh my gosh.
That's where they
were.
There
it is, man. There's a 70 grand house that they're asking 35 grand for. And of course, when it hit the paper, we call up and it was already pending. And so then we said, okay, what do we have to do? And so then 3 times a day, she would send me the hot sheets by fax. And I mean, the next sound you hear is my car start. Because remember, we even had pre-written the offers.
Yes.
All we had to fill in was the address, and boom,
and
we were done. And it was really a first game. In other words, if you were first, you probably were going to get it.
Well, and this has changed a lot because of technology, too. So System 1 in the buying systems is buying properties through the MLS first day only. So right. going from paper and faxes to now, you know, setting up automatic, immediate notifications when something gets listed and being able to get really granular on what
right.
you're looking for.
You can say, here's what I want, and boom, you and 100 or maybe 1,000 other people are simultaneously going to get it. That doesn't still it doesn't negate the value of number one. Okay. A lot of people think it's for chasing properties. It's not. It's for chasing relationships.
Very important difference.
it's one at a time at a property, but you capture an agent who has a clientele that he can say, you know, there's a world where you can get a check within a week and it's not all that bad. You paid 28 grand for this house. It's now worth 400. You got it in a probate or a will. In other words, you didn't pay anything for it. Would you like to just leave with the check? That world exists constantly, but the capturing the agent, you find that agent that's able to list properties below market pretty quickly through the first day MLS. The problem is it's usually pending. And that means somebody's in place. Okay.
So are you looking for an agent that also prices it right out of the gate?
Absolutely.
Got it.
That's what number one does. Okay. That's what system number one. It tells me they have motivated sellers and maybe that's a niche. So then you start finding out, well, it depends on what quadrant. And if you're in quadrant two, invariably they're dealing with short sales and then they're dealing with REOs. Well, that's great because they're going to be dealing with that probably for years. So the agent relationship is much more important than that property. I'd rather capture the agent and lose the property any day.
Okay. Well, let's go back real quick and talk about you. When you met Dad, what'd you think? And why did you decide to work with this guy?
Yeah, because you weren't working with investors and you were really new.
Yeah, I feel really fortunate that I met Bruce because I was only licensed for about a year when I met Bruce. And I was working in an office that had a lot of old time agents and they had a really negative attitude toward investors.
Sharks.
Mm-hmm. And I remember Bruce walking in and talking to me and telling me what he did. And I was really receptive and open to the idea. And I thought, this is great.
You didn't know any better.
Well, I thought, you know, okay. And the fantastic thing was working with him was he had a reputation of, you know, closing deals and, you know, not going out and writing an offer and then changing his mind or wanting to renegotiate. And those are all really key factors in today's market as well.
Sure.
So when we started working together, it was fantastic. Your dad was out looking at the properties and he was faxing or calling saying these are what he wanted offers written on. And we created that first day buying system that worked really well for a long time.
And also, I remember the auction. This was a fun day for me because I was at an auction and a lot of people knew who I was already. But people kept coming by, and this is your first time at an auction with me. And people kept going, coming by and saying, hey, Bruce, you know, she finally looks at me and goes, who are you?
I did.
It was kind of funny.
That is funny.
But, you know, as an investor, and I know we're getting off the first day.
That's okay.
That taught me so much about how to be a good investor and to be the investor that your dad was talking about relationships that agents will call. Because they know when they get into escrow with me, I've already seen the property. I've already done my due diligence. I'm not going to renegotiate and I'm going to close. And those are all things I learned, you know, from Bruce. And that's really key in this business and having those relationships.
Do you see that still happening a lot wearing your agent hat, people locking something up, writing an offer, and they've just never even been inside the property?
I have one in escrow right now that I'm flipping that's how I got the property. I was the second highest offer on it. It was an out of area agent. And I just said, I don't know how these numbers would even make sense for a flipper. And they went out and saw the property after they had locked it up and went back and wanted to renegotiate. And this agent kicked him out, called me.
Nice.
And she just told him, I don't need to work with you. I've already got somebody else who's seen the property and I bought it and we closed 10 days later. So it really is about, you know, doing your due diligence and writing a strong offer and conveying to that agent on the other end that you are going to close and not give them any issues.
And you want the next one.
Right.
See, that's the most important thing that happened is not that property purchase, but that connection. Mm-hmm. So that lady now knows, okay, well, and I have one of these again. And that whatever that is, it was a buying system. Mm-hmm. So whatever produced that deal is really a buying system. And that's why I always asked, how did you come by that property? And invariably, it was a buying system. It was somebody was in a probate or somebody was in foreclosure or somebody, it was a repetitive theme. And maybe this agent pursued that repetitive theme as their niche. So their farm was, if you're behind in payments, if you're in a probate, if you're whatever, mm-hmm. okay, well, that was great. I didn't have to do that. I don't understand a lot of what's going on right now because there's a lot of people that want to wear all the hats. They don't want any team members. They want to find the property themselves. So they spend 10 grand a month in mailers. Mm-hmm. They want to fund their own deals. So they deal with all the private parties directly. And I guess it's competitive. So their margins are so slim. That's what they have to do. But I think there's other people that I know that don't do any of that and have bigger margins.
Right.
And they're doing what they do best. They're finding properties instead of wearing all these hats to eliminate costs. And they're the people that are doing less are making more.
Yeah, I take two calls still, unfortunately, too often. One is, I just locked up a property. I need to go see it. Can you fund? Here are the numbers. I'm all, how are you giving me numbers if you've never seen the inside of the property? I'm all, you're about to shoot yourself in the foot if this is from the MLS. And they're like, why? So they haven't even thought about the process. And unfortunately, the other one is a lot of the national gurus are back doing the big seminars. And my favorite call is like, I'm going to get in foreclosures and all these REOs. And I literally walk them through the process of, let's go to Bank of America REO. I'm like, look from Riverside. They're like, there's four. It's changed. You've been told the wrong information and this is what you're up against. So it's unfortunate those two conversations are still happening way too frequently.
Well, I'll give you an example. In the boot camps that we used to have, one of the several hours we spent was really to get a negative response on a thing that they thought was going to be good. Call the lender directly and avoid dealing with the agents. Okay, well, let's spend 2 hours doing that. And at the end of those 2 hours, everybody was going, that was terrible. They don't want to talk to us. Exactly.
Right. Because they have a team together already
yes.
that they know is going to list, market, and sell right. the property.
Become the first person on that team. Be the person they want to call first. You don't have to deal with the lenders. You don't want to deal with the lenders.
So just briefly, because I think it's pretty clear that the technology piece has really changed. It's immediate. I mean, how often are you getting offers when you list something on the MLS?
Well, technology has really changed because Zillow offers a coming soon feature. And a lot of agents use that coming soon because a lot of agents want to double in their properties.
Why not?
Exactly. So instead of it even being in the MLS, they've put it onto the Zillow coming soon. They're already creating that buyer pool and looking at the property. The other thing is Facebook. A lot of agents are putting their properties on Facebook with the coming soon or we have this now and are selling their properties off market. But I think you're looking at two different things. We're looking at a property that's, you know, an end user property versus, property that Bruce and I would buy that has no kitchen and the pool is empty. And
that's true. Okay. That's fair.
You know, that's more of the relationship driven that we're talking about because agents that have those properties want to work with an investor that's going to close.
Yeah, because they know.
Right, they know. And especially if they're a bank REO, you know, because their performance is tracked. How close were they to their BPO price? How many days was it on market? And if it's a regular, you know, agent, and we've been doing a lot of probates lately, you know, we have heirs who are wanting to get their cash out of this property and they want it to close and they don't want to be in a 30 or 45 day escrow.
They don't want to fix anything.
And they don't want
to
fix anything.
They just want out. I've been hearing a lot of those stories lately too.
You know, I think one of the things that's lost is everyone that wholesales houses makes that decision every day. When you sell something, you're saying, I don't want retail. I want a check. I want it to be fast and I'm leaving some on the table for you. That's, in other words, we get it. There's times where that's really a benefit, not 100% of the time, but a certain percentage of the time, especially when it's a gifted house. Does it really matter if you get 100% minus closing costs, minus repairs and months of time devoted, or you just want to check where maybe it's 10% or 15% less than you would have possibly gotten going through all of that? The answer is a lot of times, yeah, it is.
Yeah. Two different skill sets, finding the properties and then taking it through the very end. Not always the same skill set. That's why I'm a buy and hold guy. Flips make my stomach hurt.
Well, I definitely will say after doing it now for a little bit, it's nerve-wracking. I'm not going to lie. You get up in the mornings and you're just like, okay, you know, we better be right. We better have done the right numbers.
Right.
The other part of exciting is closing them. I remember days where we were supposed to have 7 closings. I'm not, you know, you aren't connected to the sales side, but, you know, and we'd have 1 closing and I'd have enough money come out of that to make the payments on the hard money loans for the 20 I had that were waiting to close. It's like, right. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's stressful. Well, let's go through the quadrants. So quadrant one is sort of a fast sort of in between a boom and a bust cycle.
Yeah, it's that calm period where everybody's trying to pretend it's still okay.
So on the MLS, agents are listing these properties as prices are sort of flattening out. And what's the mood? Are people in denial?
Yeah, denial is the very first thing, absolutely, from my perspective.
Right.
Is that you just had this great run. Everything you touch turned to gold. And of course, it's going to continue and it's taking a pause. Charts don't usually do that because what happens in quadrant one is you have a rise of foreclosures and you have a rise of inventory and you have a stopping of sales and price increases. So all of a sudden these defaults convert to trustee sales that convert to REOs. And then the mix changes radically and the REOs start dictating what the number is, not the fixed house.
Right.
And that happens. And as soon as that happens, you're in quadrant two, but you're inevitably going from quadrant one to quadrant two.
Right.
And some things happen really quickly with dirt, let's say land, becomes very unpopular. So if you have land for sale, it's not going to sell. And at the very best, it's going to get an option to somebody to buy it. And they're going to string it out and see if it's going to work. And usually they fall out of escrow. So there's just some things that happen. Mobile homes, everything that's okay in quadrant four because you rationalize it at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 1-bedroom studio condo is right. But hey, at least I get to own something. It's a mobile home on a dirt road. That's okay. None of that's okay in quadrant two, and it changes really fast.
Right. Okay. And the agent at that point is also probably trying to realistically deal with the sellers that aren't understanding what's transpiring. And they're like, no, it's worth $700,000. It's about to be worth $500,000.
Right. And that was the 06 to the 07 market.
Right.
I don't know. Your dad could say much better what happened in 07, but it literally went from 06 being here to 07. The banks were not realistic at all about what their properties were worth, and buyers simply were not going to buy.
Yeah. Well, first of all, lots of people had borrowed a lot of money, so the buyers were upside down. Everybody had a big loan and had refied money out, and then they started losing their credit. So the buyer pool, at the worst case, I'm trying to think of the year exactly, but I think it was 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Something like 75% of transactions in Riverside were REO and short sale, which means 75% of the time, a close of escrow didn't replicate a buyer going forward,
right?
Which was completely ridiculous. So you had this big hole, you had this large amount of REO showing up, and there were only cash buyers to take it off the table. And that was sort of pre 2007 and 8 were pre hedge funds,
right?
It was private people. And there were 50 listings in San Bernardino for every $1,000 price increment.
I remember that, pulling those lists. So, okay, so in quadrant one, investors in the first day MLS, probably maybe it's better time spent building those relationships with the agents who are going to be focused on short sales and REOs.
There's no doubt about that. As a matter of fact, one of the things that started to happen is in, say, 2005, when we wrote the report, you'd have Michael Novak Smith in the audience.
How do you spot those agents that look like they're going to go down that route?
They've been there before.
Right.
This is repeat history.
Okay. Right?
So who was Michael Novak Smith before that? An REO agent.
Right.
And Steve Silva and on.
Right.
It's repetitive. Matter of fact, when that cycle started, I got calls from people that were doing it in the 90s. Are you still in? That was the question. They wanted to know if I can send you stuff like I used to 10 years ago.
Wow.
So that's how long those relationships last.
As well as your reputation.
Right. Well, you won't get that call if they didn't find that was good.
Okay. So quadrant two, the bust. The REO agents and short sales start to really start landing on the MLS. And that's really changed too. So technology, yeah. A lot of the banks have forced agents to basically just have a board. Here are all the properties. And they're really looking at the net, right? After so many, like, how does that work? After so many not closing, are they finally giving investors, you know, a chance? Like, what did that look like?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to look at is, you know, Fannie and HUD have what they call their first look time periods.
Right.
So, you know, they're wanting to keep those properties for the buyer pool that's going to be an owner occupant. So those type of properties, you know, they go through the first look period and then they're open to investors to be able to bid on. As far as regular inventory is concerned, again, we're talking about a property that if it doesn't have a kitchen or the pool is empty, those just aren't going to get the financing. So it's about them being realistically priced.
One of the best things that happened for investors was the city had the got the capacity to find homes.
Oh, wow. And it was different at every city. So in the city of Riverside, it could be up to like $100 per day per fine.
I thought it was $1,000.
Oh, maybe it was a limit. I forget.
It was $1,000. Well, I remember you had a listing, and I think it was in San Bernardino, where the fines were greater than the listing price by a lot.
Right.
Yeah.
So the lender was selling it and writing a check, getting paid off a little bit and having to pay off the city lien of $80,000.
Well, in this cycle, the city's also got the neighborhood stabilization fund. So all of a sudden they were competing with investors being able to buy the worst of the worst, even if they were overpaying for it. It wasn't money that they had to worry about. They were just getting it. And they couldn't end up spending a lot of their money fast enough.
What's interesting is I don't know that we're ever going to see that glut of foreclosures dealt with the old-fashioned way and caused great price damage. It seems like, you know, there's a learning curve. So the technology curve is also matched with, okay, what did we do that was successful? And it's oddest thing, like Nevada, they just said, let's don't foreclose. So you had people living in their house for 4 or 5 years without making a payment. They were upside down by so far, the lenders didn't want to touch it. They'd lose 80%. So you created a housing shortage, literally, to where the builders came in and built stuff for retail and everybody's prices rose. And all of a sudden you're going, is that the new method?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're a lender, do you want to take a 70 or 80% hit, which happened in Moreno Valley? I was buying properties at $60,000 that was going for $360,000, and the loan was $360,000. So they were getting almost an 80% or more haircut. And or do you just say, you know what, I'm going to consider it a straight note for 4 or 5 years and get 280 for it? Well, if you think about that, that's an interesting thing. But you need the cooperation of the powers that be, because in about 95, there was a dip in foreclosures, but there was an increase in NODs. And what happened is the lenders said, we're not foreclosing on them.
Right.
And they enacted a law that said within 100 days of being late, you have to.
And then it forced their hands.
So they had to foreclose, and the peak happened, and you had the worst year in 97. But this time, the lates and the NODs went through the roof, and the trustee sales went down because they just said, the heck with it.
And in 08, this down cycle, they even tried to incentivize buyers with an $8,000 tax credit, correct?
Right.
That's correct.
And it worked. I mean, it did work in the sense, but what happened is you brought forward buyers into that year. And when the $8,000 disappeared, then you really had the buyer pool that was so damaged credit-wise and mood-wise. And that's the one thing you don't have a chart for. What's the psyche damage when you have literally a Great Depression in an industry take out housing values to such an extent that you thought you were safe at 50% equity and now you're upside down? I mean, that is bizarre.
So quadrant two, what did we say the year was? The down cycle, sort of this quadrant?
This quadrant, which started in 2007
okay.
and then 2008 in earnest.
Okay, yeah.
And by the way, that's important to realize in advance that it's coming.
Oh, yeah.
Because you start getting all your anchor people on your team when they're not busy.
Right.
And then all of a sudden they get slammed and they have, 800 listings instead of 8 and you're the guy.
Yeah. And that's, and a change in the MLS is so different in the players. So in quadrant one, we talked about investors just start keeping an eye out or go back to the people that were doing the REOs possibly in the last cycle. It's likely that they're going to be picking up the torch and doing it again. And so we're here in quadrant two, talking about the first day MLS. So now it's during the downturn. So a lot of what you're saying are the short sales MLS and the, God forbid there'd be equity sellers that in your experience, is it just they're overlisting, just dreaming at this point?
That's very true. If we're talking about an 08 market, they were still in an 06 mentality.
I would have hated to deal with equity sellers in that market. That would have been really painful.
Actually, dealing with lenders wasn't any easier. They could not accept the fact that they were going to lose more than 50% of their loan. And you could see the journey of a listing. It was ridiculous. I mean, some of the properties I bought, they started, you know, a 360 loan started at 299, and they thought, oh, that's a good deal. 199.
Right.
And nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
159, and nothing happened. And you could just methodically see they had a pattern. Like every month they would revisit it and go, oh my God, we got to do it again. And they would lower it another $50,000 and get nothing. It was really interesting to watch that journey.
You know what? I didn't even think about this. The landscape of the people involved in the business really changed as well. So, I mean, it was a running joke that everybody was quitting their jobs to become a realtor in 06 because everything they touched, they didn't have to do anything and they made, you know, thousands of dollars. And then all of a sudden the downturn downturn happens, they realize they don't have any skills or relationships. So they disappear. The investors who were speculators disappear. So what you had left were people who didn't know any better because they were brand new. So they didn't have any preconceived notions of what it should be or shouldn't be. And then the realtors, in your experience, Andrea, was it just the realtors who'd been around and maybe the new guys, or the new guys disappeared and be like, this is a horrible time to be a realtor?
No, I think in 08, when we're talking about 08, I think the banks realistically thought they were just going to get rid of their inventory in about a 24-month period, and they absolutely flooded the market. I mean, when I was working the REOs, we would open what we had, this platform called Equator, and we would have tasks on Equator, and they would be in green, yellow. You never wanted red. Red was bad. And we would just wake up in a morning and have 50 new green tasks.
Oh my gosh.
And those tasks consisted of checking the property, doing BPOs, doing monthly marketing reports. And banks just really weren't realistic at that time on what they were going to really sell those properties for. They did get realistic afterwards. And as Bruce was saying, I mean, there would be one house listed at 200 and then a bank would do a BPO and list the next door neighbor at 150. And that's really what we were seeing in 2008.
The other thing that happened to the agents is there was a lot of oversight that was not physical contact with a human being. It was a methodology mm-hmm. and computerization. And they stopped listening to people that knew you're crazy. In other words, you shouldn't be listing this property. I got called by REO agents saying, you please make me a ridiculous offer so I can beat the heck up out of the lender. They needed to get jarred because they were asking something that would never happen. And what happened was the agents were getting graded. So you would have Mike Novak Smith getting listings taken from him, let's say, because he didn't sell them. So he got a bad grade, and handing them to Steve Silva, who's about to get a bad grade because the price is still bad.
Right.
I mean, there wasn't anything you'd do. I mean, everything was in a free fall. We were trying to buy and sell properties at the time, and we were having to calculate what's our hold time and reduce the listing price by 3 or 4% a month.
Yeah.
That was like a rock just going boop.
Craig did an amazing job with that. That was such a hard market to flip in, and he still made it work.
Yes.
That was pretty awful. So as far as the first day MLS, it's important to note that the investor who they're up against, you've got somebody like a Mike Novak Smith who went from 0 to 60 in a matter of, you know, a year. So having that many listings at one time and the carrying costs, that's the other fascinating thing. Oh. You know, the talk was like, what if one of these banks go under and I'm carrying over $100,000 worth of utility bills, trash, you know, I mean, that's insane. It's not like they were front loading like, oh, hey, thanks for the listing. Here's $20,000 to handle all the fees.
That's correct. We had to bill to get reimbursed for everything.
Yeah.
That was the 08 market. They got a little bit smarter in about 10, where they started having a lot of outside companies. But in 08, the agents were really responsible for everything. We fronted everything, the utilities, the pool person, the gardener, cash for keys, and yes.
And if they didn't have you on the ground, they could also have the great benefit of being fined every day by whatever city you were in.
Right. We dealt with a lot of properties that they fined us for dead yards. Riverside made a lot of money back then for dead yards.
Yep. I've seen some of those fines. Negotiated some of those fines. Yeah, that's pretty dangerous. So putting the realtor hat on, you've got all these investors hitting you up when you're just slammed. Is there any good way to do that at that point with the technology in place, knowing that, you know, at certain periods of time, they had very little control? It was just a numbers game.
I think for 08 and 09, you know, we had some really great asset managers, and they would call. They wanted feedback back then. They would say, you know, I got your BPO, you know, why are you bringing it in at this? You know, why do you think we need to so substantially cut this? And at that time, they were kind of looking at what their appraised value was at the time that they had sold the property. And they would ask, you know, how can we have this house in Moreno Valley at $300,000 and it's a two-bedroom in Moreno Valley at $300,000? And you just want to say, because you never should have had a $300,000 two-bedroom house in Moreno Valley.
With the car parked on the lawn. Yeah.
Exactly. And it took them about a year. And then the asset managers really, I think, became pretty receptive of understanding that we were here knowing what was going on. And if they wanted their property sold, that they really did need to read our BPOs and to listen to our comments. And it was a great about 2 years. And then things changed in 10. That's when the robo-signing started. And that's a whole different...
The MERS stuff. Okay.
Yeah, that started.
So if you were an investor, first day, you get a notification out of the MLS that there's this listing. It's priced decently. Is there anything you can do to get that deal? I mean, I know we're going after the relationship, but doing your due diligence, and you're seeing a lot of properties, trying to go inside from the realtor standpoint, is there anything you think that investors could have done better or not done to...
I'll tell you one thing that most people completely ignored, myself included, was the auto emails. Oh, I see you just listed this property. I'm an investor. I'd like to buy it. Call me. Okay, we're just not going to respond to those emails.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know, especially
you have an automated response. No.
And, you know, the other one, of course, is they would the house would be listed for, like your dad said, $60,000, and we'd get an offer for $20,000, and we'd be just like, you really can't want us to present that to our bank. I mean, you know, we have to be a little bit realistic here. And there is a process to that. I mean, asset managers will listen to you as an agent if you have a good track record of moving their property. You know, that's, and the other thing about investors is, when we call an asset manager and say, you know, Mr. Norris is, you know, this is like his 12th one that he's bought from us this month, he'll close. You know, back then in 08, we were able to get asset managers to listen to us, and they had a little bit of power and influence to be able to take Bruce's offer, because it was all about getting him off the books.
Mm. And if you're on the investor side, you're thinking, okay, how do I make this offer stronger than anybody else's? And so, you know, that's what you're thinking is, okay, I'm now looking at through the eyes of a seller. If they're going to do this price, they just want it to close.
Correct.
And so you just have to make that a no-brainer. So when you get an offer, maybe, especially if you're trying to tie up a relationship, I'm paying cash. Here's my deposit is $63,000. The purchase price is $60,000. It's the closing cost too. I'll get a check back. It's in the form of a cashier's check. Mm-hmm. It's over.
That's correct.
Now, then that's a good story. So is it helpful to be first out of the gate? If it's listed on the MLS, within 24 hours, an investor has seen it, told the story to you of what needs to be done, and come in with all cash. Does that make a difference?
I think when you're talking about the 2008, 2009 market, mm-hmm. I think that you did have opportunities to be first, because banks were trying to liquidate property. They were wanting them off of the books. They weren't wanting them sitting there. So it's a different story now.
Okay. Well, let's get into that. So I think we've beat up the downturn. So now we've got
right. So you're
three.
In quadrant two, you're dealing with a really motivated seller.
Right.
Okay.
So now we go into three, which is sort of like another semi-short period of time where we've hit the bottom and we're sort of flattening out. First day MLS listings come out, and maybe there's more options. It's so we're maybe going from a buyer's market to a little bit more of a balance with the seller's market. So how does it change? You just said that. So
it's, well, that's subtle. If you're in three, you don't even know it occurred until you look back. So like 99, you look back and go, oh, we didn't go down this year. It's not like stark.
Oh, I guess that's true.
It's just blah.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you start to see, usually it's construction that starts, and that brings in the migration of construction workers. And all of a sudden we get off to the races and a little higher and off we go. So for an investor to understand what to do in quadrant three, you can really do well, because if you have had dirt through quadrant two, you are the loneliest person in the world. No one has called you to say, can I buy your lot? No one said, can I take the tax bill away from you so I can mow the weeds for 5 years?
Right.
Okay, so quadrant three is one of those, if you have charts that say, okay, that's over. But if you're a landholder, it's not over for you. You're still mowing the weeds and no hope of having an out of that expense. That's a perfect time to option dirt, because you know, okay, I'm going to be able to use this stuff in a few years, and I'm going to buy this stuff for nothing, because it is worth nothing. It doesn't pencil.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So that's why the quadrant system is kind of cool, because you're always doing the right thing in advance of when it's worth something. So try that in quadrant four. Everyone that has dirt goes, oh my God, this is so great.
So, well, in the scope of the first day MLS, the realtor, what you sort of hinted that something changed. So you were talking about being first could matter in 08. When did it change?
Yeah, I think in 08, again, we had a lot of motivated banks who were wanting to liquidate their inventory, and they wanted to work with investors that were going to close. You know, when it started changing was when the market started improving. And then people were, you know, I don't really need to take the first offer.
Okay.
Well, you're 97% sellers that own stuff that have equity too.
Correct.
So it doesn't mean there's not motivated private sellers. It means there's less of them. There's not mm-hmm. the dominant number of percentage of REOs or anything. So now it's going to be the isolated case of somebody that's got equity that wants to sell. And I think what we had touched on maybe off air was that it's gone to a point where a lot of that's going to happen. It's going to get double ended though. So
the double ending cycle.
So you still have that first day motivated seller, but now it's being contained by somebody that says, I already have the investor. I'm going to flip this and earn both sides of it. And so that's still there. It just may not be the same methodology that I'll go to the MLS and find a deal. No, it's where you start. As a matter of fact, one of the things you ought to do, you ought to pull comps and see how whatever went pending in a day or two was priced right. That's the agent I'm going to call and say, this is what I do.
Okay.
I'm going to try and I'm going to work my way into number two position. I know I'm not going to get to be number one yet until I get a chance. And when you get a chance, then you pour it on. And so how you pour it on, you make an offer, and you, if you can do it, you write an all cash offer and there's the cash. It's sitting there.
Right.
And all of a sudden the agent goes, I like this guy better, man. It's easier. And you can slide into number one because that's what they want. They just want an easy transaction.
Okay.
The other thing is the reputation part has legs. Remember we did a transaction. It was in Norco, I think, where didn't we have a room addition underneath a septic tank underneath a room addition? And a call was never made to the REO agent to complain. It just, it wasn't. It's not what you do.
Your dad just jackhammered up the floor and didn't tell me. Oh. And then I walked in and we had this big pile of dirt.
It was like a earth was inside a house.
Oh, no.
Not a mound of earth. A mound of earth that was 7 feet, 6 inches high. And remember, it was pending? Yeah. And the young couple brought their folks in to see what they're buying.
Oh, no.
Whoops.
But your dad is touching on something like that happened last year. We had an REO that we had purchased during the summer. We rehabbed it. It had a skylight and a bathroom. And I bought this house. There was 20 offers on it. And I went, met the agent, introduced myself, sat and talked to him for like 15, 20 minutes. Mine wasn't the highest offer. But because I had gone out, done my due diligence, established a relationship with this agent, and he was new in the business. He also happened to be an attorney that worked with seniors. And that's who owned this house. And that's how I ended up buying that property, because he just felt like I was going to do what I said. We did close. But my point of that was the skylight ended up leaking after they closed escrow. And the agent posted something on Facebook about this skylight leaking. And so I called her and I said, why didn't you call me about the skylight leaking? And she said, why would I call you? And I said, because I'll take care of it for you. We didn't know what was going to leak. You know, we bought it during the summer.
The assumption is that you weren't going to.
Exactly. And she was shocked. And we sent our people out there. We replaced the skylight for them. We fixed the drywall. That, you know, whatever cost us, a couple thousand dollars, made for the best relationship for that agent and for those people, because we took care of them. And that's what's really important being an investor. It's not just when you close the house. It's what happens after you close as well. And agents remember that.
Yeah, by the way, you sold Piedmont. I heard that the owner knows us. You went over there to check that it didn't flood?
Yeah, they had a really heavy rain. Remember, we had fixed that.
Yeah.
But it had been a while since we had a really heavy rain. So after it closed, I don't know how long it was, but I went over there and his wife was going, really?
Who are you and why are you here?
But that's important. And that's what's going to create longevity as an investor for you, is not only how you treat the agents on the front end, but how you treat the agents and the people that buy the house on the back end.
And because I know Andrea, this is who she is. And it's important. It's not like a technique.
Mm-hmm.
It's just who you might as well end up being in business, because it's the only way you survive and have long-term relationships, is that you're honorable. You might as well just say, you know, that's who I'm going to be in business, because I need to be to have a successful referral base, because they already know what to expect. That's what everyone wants to know. If it hits the fan, it's going to be okay.
Right. So going back to your, first day MLS, is there still are opportunities on the first day MLS. It really is how you present yourself to that offer, or to that agent, excuse me, when you want to write your offer.
I'm glad we're talking about this, because even I think a lot of people would write this off because of technology. Oh, you're not going to be first. It's not fax and printed papers. We still have the terrible edges on the side anymore.
Correct.
I'm glad it's taken this turn, because I don't think reading the chapter of how to do this, it necessarily reads the relationship as deep as it needs to be, especially now. So let's move on to quadrant four. So we're in quadrant four. It's definitely a seller's market. You know, if you've got a good property listed at a decent price, it's going to get beat up. But again, you've got investors. Are they writing offers without seeing it more oftentimes than not?
Well, you keep talking about technology, and that's what I will say for quadrant four, is investors, and especially new investors, will write dozens of offers based on what they see on the internet. They don't go see the property.
Zillow says this, though.
Well, Zillow does say that. And that is one of the biggest problems, because they will write offers that they haven't done their numbers. They're writing over what the property really is going to be worth once they fix it up to flip it. Mm-hmm. And then they go see the property, and then they go, oh my gosh, we didn't know it didn't have a kitchen, or that it backed up to the freeway, or, you know, that the bathroom was completely gone, or this room addition has mold and we need to tear it down. And then they want to renegotiate. And that is what makes agents mad, because mm-hmm. they have, you know, accepted their offer, they've accepted the terms, and then they go and view the property and want to renegotiate the offer.
And we ought to mention that in quadrant four, there's really not a suggestion that the first day MLS be one of your lead buying systems.
No, not right. at all. Yeah. Okay. No, this is going to have been the course, and we specifically want to sort of capture this history of how it changes over time and how technology has changed. Okay. So, no, this is good. So,
but you also want to realize, as a buyer, what happens is you're in quadrant two and you have all these foreclosures. That's a skill set.
Yeah.
It's a relationship driven. How can I get this person to say, okay, this is a valuable team member, and we're going to do that for 5 years? When you get to quadrant four, you're dealing usually with an owner directly mm-hmm. off of a mailer or a sign. Completely different skill set. And, you know, the MLS has taken a back seat. So as an investor, the whole idea of the buying system is to say, okay, let me look at a set of charts so I can figure out how to best use my day tomorrow.
Yeah.
Okay. So in quadrant four, because you've thought about this after quadrant two, maybe you own 30 building lots or a Rosamond project because you tied it up when no one wanted dirt and you got to build it at the peak of quadrant four. So that's what you're thinking about in quadrant three, is how I'm going to cash this in, when it's all about, do you have inventory instead of, are you trying to get a deal out of the MLS? You would like to be presenting inventory to the MLS at that point.
Right.
Because you've thought about the process that's going to happen in quadrant four.
And when people call in and tell me that they're working sort of the MLS in general, that's a conversation we have. I'm like, well, what's your angle? Like, are you going after stuff with hair on it? Like, where nobody's bidding because there's some real reasons, whether it's mold or cracked slab. If they're new, I'm like, is that appropriate for you? Do you have a background? So yeah, that's definitely a
concern.
And
in quadrant four, the answer is that's the only opportunity you're going to get the big discounts, is that it doesn't have
right.
anything that can get financing, and maybe an expandable structure to where you're in a county that goes for $800 a foot, and it's a 900 square foot structure, and most right. of the houses there are 2,500 square feet. That's perfect.
Yeah, and that changes by city too. You really have to make sure there's a lot of cities locking it down.
They even want you to do it.
Yeah. Pasadena, LA. I know several markets who don't want McMansions anymore.
Yeah.
Okay. So quadrant four MLS, there's limited inventory. So this is very relationship driven, and the people you make relationships are with just very different. So a lot of the stuff isn't even hitting the MLS, the stuff that we're buying. I still do see short sales and REOs come through the lending division, but, you know, just not as often.
Right.
Short sales, REOs. And,
right. It becomes a smaller piece.
Yeah, smaller and smaller. You know, let's drop this here. I still get a lot of questions on whether it's valuable or not to get the sales agent's license in this quadrant in general. I like the education piece of it, especially if somebody's new, has no background in real estate. I like having the three courses. I think it's very helpful. But the risk, everybody's so worried about the risk involved. You've had your license since when?
Since the day I opened the Norris Group, so 95. Every conversation that I've ever had to deal with that, are you licensed? I interpret that question as, are you trying to get a listing?
Mm.
And so that was the question I would answer. I would say, I have a license as a realtor, as an appraiser, and I don't want to appraise your house or list it. What I want to do is hear what your situation is and see if I can help you get to the finish line. If I'm part of it, that's great. And so that's how we started. But usually I never had somebody hang up because I had a license. If I explained it, I'm not interested in the listing.
Okay.
I saw a fantastic sign, by the way, just recently.
What's that?
It was a sign where you normally say, we buy fixer uppers.
Mm-hmm.
It was a broker sign that said, we help people that own fixer uppers.
That's a good sign.
That is a great sign.
I haven't even really seen those.
Yeah.
That's a good angle.
It is a great angle. I mean, really, it is a great angle, because you're going to get the guy that's fixing them up, and you may get the guy that has one.
I've heard of a realtor in San Diego that she does the contracting work and somehow figures out a cost share with the seller.
Okay.
They're willing to front the money to do the repairs.
Right.
Pretty interesting. So back to the question about the sales agent. Have you had problems wearing both hats as a flipper or an agent?
You know, it's interesting, because as a realtor, I like people to know that I'm still a realtor.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're talking about an end user who either is going to list their house or buy a house. But as far as an investor, I don't really ever have an issue, because I make it very clear when I'm contacting the agent that I'm not contacting them because I want to write the offer.
Right, you're not getting the commission.
Right. Yeah. I make it very clear that I don't want to represent myself, that I want them to represent me, and that I'm just disclosing to them that, by the way, I just happen to have
right.
a real estate license.
But that's not why I'm calling you.
Yeah, you don't want to wear the commission hat and the equity hat at the same time.
To me, if you want to be an investor, it's never about the commission. And Bruce taught me that, too, on selling our flips. I had someone contact me a couple months ago that asked me if I would list their flips for 1%. And I just said, you know, you really need to find another agent.
Yeah.
But I said to him, I'm going to give you some free advice. If you're trying to put together a team as a flipper and a property investor, treat your people right. And trying to ask someone to sell for 1% is not treating your people right.
Yeah. You'll get replaced by somebody that'll do it for 0.75%, but then they're going to get what they paid for. That's the short-sightedness of what I see going on. A lot of things happened in the early 90s. I met you, and all of a sudden we go to auctions. We're buying 6 houses at a day, and we're sitting there, and I needed Craig. Well, I didn't want to have to invent the money wheel. And I, you know, it was just one of those things where you realize, gosh, Craig is there, and my money's going to fund. And I'm just loyal to that team.
It's important. Well, it's a long-term
investor,
play.
Yeah, as an investor, you really have to have a good team, and that's what's really important. Your contractors, your agents. Yeah,
exactly. I was going to say the whole thing. I mean, I'm meeting Friday with a guy, Gary's Carpeting and L&H Painting, and I've done business with them for 3 decades.
Yeah.
So I already know what to expect.
I'll end with this question. This specific buying strategy took longer than I thought it was going to, but we covered a lot of ground. If you are a brand new investor, is a first day MLS a good strategy to hit up?
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just going to answer. It really depends on the quadrant. It really does.
Okay.
It's going to be the main one in quadrant 2 and a sub partner in any other quadrant. Quadrant 2 is the main relationship driven quadrant where you're going to make relationships that are going to last for years, REO and short sale. Mm-hmm. First day listing is filled with that stuff every day. So if I was just starting in the quadrant 2, that's absolutely what I do. I drive relationships to get repetitive inventory.
All right. Quadrant 4, maybe not so much. Okay. Well, with that, awesome. Thanks so much, guys.